while I sit and whisper your name. Four walls to hear me, four walls to see, four walls to hear me, closing in on me. Sometimes I ask why I'm waiting, but my walls have nothing to say. I'm made for love, not for hating. So here, where you left me, I'll stay. One night with you is like heaven, and so while I'm walking the floor, I listen to steps in the hall and wait for your knock on my door.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. Radio Network, yeah, right here in Warsaw, Indiana, Midwest. Yeah. Well, let's see here. It is the 30th of July, 2015. So you've only got a few hours left to get it done. So no matter how nefarious or how funny or how jovial or whatever it is, you better get it done, but don't tell anybody. Well, let's look back here in the old calendar, which I keep a lot of records on, and I haven't referred to it lately. But in July, we had a couple of things of note happen. And that was, number one, Don Musgrove, who was my right-hand man, especially on legal matters, for quite some time. And he sort of introduced me to the facts of life about what things were like in the street. He's passed away now. He was born in 1947. He was the oldest living cystic fibrosis victim when he died. And they tried all kinds of new treatment, all kinds of experimental drugs, didn't do him a damn bit of good. But the thing that kept him going was, guess what? You'll never guess. Coca-Cola and aspirin. Every day he'd drink Coca-Cola and aspirin, and that did him more, gave him more relief than any of the drugs the doctors were feeding him. Yeah. Don Musgrove was associated with George Lincoln Rockwell here on the West Coast. I mean, in California, when Rockwell would come to California. He was acquainted with the Oakland Suicide Squad, and I've told you about that many times. I'll tell you again, that's where a few of the more radical National Socialists of Rockwell had an apartment right down there in the ghetto. Yes, the ghetto. They had an apartment in the ghetto. This shows you what kind of guys they were. And they flew a swastika flag out their second-story apartment window every day. And the black militants were afraid of them. So Huey Newton, one time, when he was the head of the Black Panthers, I believe, he was boasting and carrying on, and the Oakland Suicide Squad boys strapped on their weapons, and they went over to his headquarters and stood outside and said, "Come on out, Huey. Come on out, Huey. We want to talk to you." And Huey is inside, cowering down, screaming out, "I don't want any problem with you guys. We got no problem. But that's all right. Go away." So the guys went back to their apartment. There was some real interesting people in that Oakland Suicide Squad, and that's the only place that George Lincoln Rockwell felt really safe. Really safe. Because these guys were not kidding around. They did some wild-ass stuff. And when Rockwell came out to the West Coast and he wanted to work on his book, this time The World, he stayed with them and he knew he was safe. Yeah, right. So that was Don Musgrove. Hell of a guy. He saved me from an assassination back in the day. If I hadn't had him around and listened to his advice, I wouldn't be around today, I'll tell you that. Henry Ford was born in 1863. Of course, I have mixed emotions about Henry Ford. In some ways, I have to give him a tribute for developing the car, the people's car, really, long before Hitler came up with the Volkswagen. The Model A, Model T were the people's car. And also that he was the first guy in the country that paid workers a decent wage. But then as he went on, and later on, he got a little funny, and the workers got all upset with him. And there was a major strike, Henry Ford. Also, he built a truck factory in the Soviet Union and was manufacturing trucks for the Communist Soviet Union. And, of course, when World War II broke out, that was converted real easily into a tank factory and so forth like that. So Henry Ford was an interesting individual. There's always two sides, maybe three sides to any individual. The side we agree with, the side we vehemently disagree with, and the side that's in the middle that says, well, okay. But that's Henry Ford. He was born in 1863 on July 30th. That's today. We got one more day, I see, the 31st. Oh, yeah, Nathan Bedford Forrest, born 1821, on the 13th. Nathan Bedford Forrest knew how to take care of black people that gave problems. Most of these guys in the South, most of them weren't cruel people, but they did demand obedience. And in military parlance, he was a genius. He was a forerunner to many of the modern people like Patton and so forth. Firstus with the mostus. He used to come up, he came up one time on one side of the river with his cavalry, and it was a force three, four times his size of the Union on the other side. And he got his men on their horses, and they just went around and around. They made a sort of a big circle, like a racetrack. And they'd appear, and then they'd disappear, go through the woods, come back again to where it looked like they had thousands of troops, and scared the shit out of the Yankees. I think the Yankees took off, yeah. So anyhow, that's Nathan Bedford Forrest, born on the 13th of July, yes. My wife used to keep very close records of where I was and what we did every day to protect us from the you-know-who people. I was just looking over this from 1991, and I could see we were pretty busy that month. There was a cookout. I think that was with the Klan. Maybe not. No, that was after the Klan, 1991. And on the 5th, we were out with some of our friends, and we went to see the movie Rocky V. And let's see here. A lot of family stuff on here. Oh, yeah, Winston Burbidge, who was one of our men, was sentenced in L.A. Unfortunately, he pled out in a case where we all did not plead out. And so that was the end of our association, and he'd been an associate for a long time. But our deal was nobody pleads out. Let's see here. Oh, a Mexican TV reporter was at my house. I think I talked to her two or three times. And that was on the 15th, and on the 16th, the kids went to Knott's Berry Farm. And then on the 17th, Channel 8 was at the community center, I guess, having an interview with me. I see on the 18th, my son John was a hearing on exemption. That was leading up to some trial or something. Hey, let's see here. Well, I was in L.A. court at 10:30 on the 22nd. Readiness hearing for the trial. Hey, let's see here. Well, there's a whole lot of stuff on here, but most of it's personal and private. Oh, Tom and John were in L.A. court, stayed in L.A. all night. That was on the 31st. Oh, we were there on the 30th, too. Oh, we spent a lot of time in court back in the day, but they didn't get us. They didn't get us. Well, that's not quite true. They got me for 45 days. 45 days just because the judge was an asshole. He was certainly an asshole. An ex-cop, who I've told you many times, brutalized the blacks down in the black ghetto when he was a cop on the beat. That was the information that other attorneys told me. One of the meanest bastards in L.A. Police Department. But when he's a judge, he was coming down hard on me. But you see, because you got to understand, it's okay for cops to beat the living shit out of. And we knew this way back. They're just starting to discover this today. That cops routinely beat the shit out of and kill niggers. Well, we knew that a long time ago. And we don't like the cops, unless they're decent professional cops. Once in a while, you run into a cop like that, and that upholds the law, and they're actually peace officers. That's what all cops should be. The minute they start calling law enforcement officers, things started going bad, things went bad faster. So when I see in the news some cop has killed a black and over some stupid thing like a lane change, I said, well, what's new? That's been happening for decades. And now it's happening more because you've got a lot of inferior quality people joining the police force. I mean, hell, in L.A. and San Francisco, they were recruiting gangbangers to be cops about 5-10 years ago. Nobody seems to remember that. They wonder why these guys are nasty and beat the shit out of people. Well, you got gangbangers with badges. So anyhow, for a certain amount of the right wing who expect me to go gaga on side with the cops, no, because there are more white people being brutalized by cops than blacks. And you can go to, I forget what website it is, they've got the figures on that. Maybe I'll think of it before the show is over. Incidentally, today I'm doing the show on a small electronic recorder, about 4x8, with a headset. I had to run my newest of my old computers over to the computer man, a friend of mine, because I wanted to set it up for the new Microsoft 10, which he showed me while I was there at his shop this morning, and that's good. It's free. You guys should... And he found out that he didn't know it would override a previous program, but he put it in an older computer, and it wiped all the rest of it out and came right up with a new Microsoft 10, and it looks real good, and it's free. So I'd recommend that. He's putting it on mine today. So I'm sitting here with a little teeny recording device, but it's pretty good because it's digital. I bought two of them out of, they were closing out at Radio Shack about 6 months ago. Once you get to know how to operate them, they're not as easy as a regular one to operate. Once you get to know how to operate them, they're pretty damn good, and they will go for a long, long time on batteries. So anyhow, that's the story there. We got to get our bad old days information up here. How about it? Oh, yeah, there was one thing I forgot to tell you about Don Musgrove. He was born up in San Francisco, and I've got a picture somewhere in my files of Don Musgrove throwing a Marxist agitator, red Progressive Labor Party member, through a plate glass window up in San Francisco when George Lincoln Rockwell went down to the docks and he was attacked by the Progressive Labor Party. And Musgrove was he wasn't as big as I am, and he was sick, and there he was in that picture throwing a red through a plate glass window to protect George Lincoln Rockwell. And also, he was the guy that cops could throw in jail and he'd just laugh at him. He could be laying on the floor of a cell, maybe even bleeding from the mouth or something, and he would laugh at the cops. He would never let them give him any shit, even if they beat on him. That was a real National Socialist, a real white racist. Yeah. Okay, Pessimist Guide to History. Where are we at here? Get my glasses on here. Might be easier. Okie dokie. 5000 BC, volcanic eruption creates Crater Lake. Yeah. A spectacular eruption of the volcano Mount Mazama, located in what is today the Cascade Mountain Range in Oregon, blew away the upper portion of the volcano cone. The remnants of the volcano filled with water, creating a 6-mile-wide crater lake. The area is now an ecologist and vacationer's delight. Some scientists think it may be the only temporarily dormant. However, it might blow again. Incidentally, I got an ad from Israel today. I should have it up here on the screen, but I don't. Save the Lake Galilee, the Sea of Galilee. They're saying they got problems there, and they want everybody to chip in and buy a little piece of the Lake Galilee, I guess around the shore. I didn't read it straight, but evidently they're trying to get all these Christians to buy. This is their latest scam, to sell off a few inches to each one of the Christians that's got a lot of money. Now, that's the one I was just on here a few weeks ago, Lake Galilee. But if the Galilee is in really in trouble, then Israel's in real trouble, because that's where all the water goes that comes down from the northern Israel mountains through the Jordan River down to Lake Galilee, and that's their source of water. So if they got a real problem with Galilee drying up, Israel's got a big, big problem. Okay, let's see here. I'll do one more here today. From The Pessimist's Guide to History. Everybody needs one of these. 5,000 years ago, a giant meteor hit Arizona. Oh, yeah, I've been there two or three times. The desert of present-day Arizona is scarred by a circular crater some 4/5 of a mile across and 550 feet deep, with the rim 150 feet high. It was dug in less than a second, sometime between 5,000 and 50,000 years ago. Well, that's a big spread, between 5,000 and 50,000. Can't you be more accurate than that? By a massive nickel-iron meteorite that may have been as big as a 10-story building or even larger. Hurtling towards the Earth at a speed of 10 miles per second, the meteorite began to burn as soon as it hit the Earth's atmosphere. White-hot chunks of nickel iron as large as houses probably broke off, burning up in the atmosphere behind it. A column of compressed, superheated air was pushed in front of the falling meteorite, fanning out as it approached the Earth's surface and scorching to cinders everything on the ground within a 100-mile radius. Wouldn't that have been something to ruin your day, riding your horse along there in the old days? What the hell is that? When the meteorite struck, it drove through a quarter mile of solid rock, smashing it to dust. The impact is believed to have blasted 300 million tons of rock into the air, scattering fragments of rock and meteor for 6 miles. And they must have had a lot of dust up in the atmosphere, too. Things might have gotten dark in Arizona at that time. Anyhow, that's enough of that for today. Let me get my mark in here so I don't read it to you again. Okay, now what are we going to do? Let's see here. We're going to go back to the South and the White Knights of Mississippi. I don't know. You guys don't criticize much, and you don't say anything, you know, too positive either. Some of you do. So I don't know what you like, what you don't like. So I'm just choosing it as I go along and hope you like it. I guess you do, because everybody keeps sending in their donation. So incidentally, it's almost time for July. Okay, here we go. Back to the book Terror in the Night by Jack Nelson, who was a reporter for the LA Times for a long time. The broader issue of holding interracial gatherings in the synagogue created a range of controversy inside the Beth Israel congregation. I'll bet it did. A month after the dedication, of course, don't kid yourself. There are all kinds of Jews that are racist as hell. They call the niggers Schwarzers and everything else like that. So, and over in Israel, they've got a racist party. A white Jewish racist party. It's pretty strong, too. They have demonstrations and everything else. And now that they got nearly 150,000 nigger Somalians or Ethiopians in there claiming they're Jews, they're really pissed off. A month after the dedication, Nussbaum, rabbi, endured what he conceded was one of the roughest congregational meetings that I've ever attended. He was stripped of his authority to approve non-Jewish meetings at the temple. The controversy within the congregation received no outside publicity, but the larger Jackson community was well aware that the blacks had participated in the dedication of the new temple. Boy, they were waving the flag in front of Tommy Terrence. I could see Tommy Terrence when he heard that. I'm going to get those yids. Probably some of the yids wanted to get the yids. For almost everyone in Jackson, the spring and summer of 1967 were a period of mounting strain. You know, I think it was almost a tactical error to go after the Jews in Jackson, because they were pretty much split down the middle, or maybe more than that, as segregationists. And they were, most of them, or a lot of them, were opposed to these northern rabbis coming down and all that. I think I would have let them stew in their own crap at that point and concentrate on the power structure, if you know what I mean. The customs and values that had shaped life in Mississippi for more than 200 years, the unwritten assumption of white Christian ascendancy, seemed under attack from almost every quarter. You know, what pisses me off is the Christian thing. They just can't get away from it. Oh, incidentally, during the night I was listening to a story about, was it Pakistan? I think it was Pakistan, where there's actually non-believing Pakistanis. Yeah, and they're a minority, of course, but they're putting up blogs and so forth as Pakistani atheists. Now, that's pretty damn ballsy. I mean, you know, anywhere you go where you got religious fanatics, I mean, that would be a risky deal. Well, several of them have been assassinated, murdered. Just for saying, well, we don't agree with you. We don't believe in old Mohammed. And it was quite a story. It was on the BBC about 3 a.m. Stuff that you don't hear about during the day. You don't see it on CNN either. But they're still operating, and they still got blogs over there in Pakistan. They got talking about balls. Okay, back to the book. The federal government was still pushing for voting rights. The right to vote for one asshole over another asshole. I mean, all of this is it's a zoo. It's silly. Voting rights. You know, the blacks got the voting rights. Well, in a way, it did help them because then the federal government let them take over some of the city governments and so forth, and maybe even a governorship here and there. But in the end, it means very little. School desegregation and equal opportunities in the workplace. The FBI was no longer a passive observer as it had been in the early days of the civil wrongs movement. On March the 7th, the White Knights blew up the Blackwell Real Estate Company office in Jackson for selling houses to blacks in previously all-white neighborhoods. The Bureau investigated so vigorously that one of the Klansmen confessed to participating in the bombing, identified Danny Joe Hawkins, and another Klansman as accomplices, and agreed to testify against them. An all-white jury acquitted Hawkins, but the intensity of the FBI's investigation was not lost on the Klan. Blacks themselves also had become more assertive, for which they paid a heavy price. Only 3 years earlier, during the Freedom Summer of massive demonstrations, most Mississippi blacks had been so terrorized that persuading individuals to try to register to vote had been difficult. Now they turned out in mass to protest on issue after issue. More than 1,000 had marched outside the all-white state legislature in 66. As 1967 dawned, students at the predominantly black Jackson State College began protesting the activities of the police on campus. On May the 10th, students and non-students clashed with police, setting fire to barricades that had been set up to seal off the area. The next day, the state police and National Guard were brought in. When protesters began throwing rocks and bricks at a line of police, some of the officers opened fire with shotguns. Some fired into the air, but some apparently aimed at the crowd of protesters. A young black truck driver named Benjamin Brown was hit. Though a former youth worker and civil wrongs activist, Brown had taken no part in the protest. Instead, he was on an errand getting a sandwich for his wife, who was expecting their first child. At the sound of the first gunshot, Brown began to run. He was struck in the back and the head by police buckshot. Brown died the next day on his 22nd birthday. Police attributed his death to a wild shot. This reminds me of Christmas Addicts. You know the story about the black who, now they've got him built into the guy that helped the American Revolution and helped defeat the British. He's a black there, and I think it was Boston. And he came around the corner, and the British were shooting at the revolutionaries, and he came around the corner at the wrong time, and I think they killed him. Now they got Christmas Addicts High School in Indianapolis, Indiana. That's been there for years. And so they, all of a sudden, this Negro that made the wrong turn on the street is a superhero. By now, Rabbi Nussman seemed at times to be courting controversy. After the Six-Day War ended and a smashing victory for Israel in June 67, with the help of the entire military-industrial complex of the United States, And after then, there's very soon, they attacked the USS Liberty and killed a whole bunch of American citizens, which Israel has never apologized for. Anyhow, an evangelist named Annas Shorosh, a Baptist minister and a native of Jordan, delivered a blistering attack on the Jewish state. In remarks reported by the Jackson Clarion, Shorosh accused Israel of dividing Palestine and taking the best land, which they did. The American news media, he said, continued to push the Jewish viewpoint, even though 15,000 of my people in Jordan were slaughtered in 3 days last week, which is true. And if you'll ever see this documentary I saw while I was in Israel, maybe they won't let it out of the country, where all these six-day war veterans told the real story of the six-day war and how they gunned down innocent people all along the roads, and any Muslim caught in the desert or anything was just gunned down, man. They murdered them like mad. And these were Israeli veterans that told about this. I should have written down the title of this documentary. Hopefully it gets shown in this country, because it's totally out of sync with what the Israeli nitwit puts out. That's Netanyahu. Nussbaum, in a scathing rebuttal also printed in the Clarion Ledger, accused the evangelist of a blatantly malicious canard, adding, "People of all religious faith and nationalities and races this side of the Iron Curtain have expressed their admiration for the courage of some 2 million Israelis daring the might of several times that number of Arabs encouraged by the USSR to make good their threat to drive them into the Mediterranean, and whose heroic efforts led to the military victory hardly anyone thought possible." Well, perhaps if the Israelis had not illegally attacked the Muslims, that might have happened. I don't know. But it was the Israelis who were the aggressors. And what these Israelis, they can't be primarily loyal to the United States. They'll always be at least half loyal to this bandit state in Israel, which is not a religious state at all. It's a lie. The exchange between Nussbaum and Shorosh was a sensation in Jackson, which was not accustomed to have its religious leaders mix so openly into international politics. In July 1967, Nussbaum also played host to a meeting of the Jackson chapter of the Ken Deans Mississippi Council on Human Relations. It reminds me of my challenge to the Human Relations Commission of Oceanside, California, where I kept showing up and demanding to speak. And finally, they disbanded the whole commission just to keep me out of the picture. That's right. Yeah, they demanded the whole Human Relations Commission in Oceanside, California. If you doubt that, go back to the records of the Oceanside newspaper at that time, and you can see it. One time I had several Klansmen with me. We went in there. We were all carrying canes because we found out it was legal for us to carry canes to protect ourselves. Later, the cops said, "You can't do that either." But anyhow, there's pictures of these Klansmen around the perimeter of the meeting hall. That caused quite a ruckus. Anyhow, the chapter had been inactive during the preceding year and a half, but have revived with increased tempo of civil rights activity. An FBI report on the meeting, compiled in September as part of the Bureau's bombing investigation, quoted an informant as saying, "Three earlier requests to use the synagogue for interracial meetings had been turned down before permission was granted on the July 27th meeting." It reported that of the 130 people who attended, 40% were black, and pointedly noted that the meeting had been announced in advance on radio and the newspaper. one religious group that resisted any ecumenical attempts was the Baptist. Those Southern Baptists, man, you got to watch them. Largely because of opposition from Bob Hederman, the publisher of the Clarion Ledger. He and his brother Tom, who was the editor of the paper, exerted enormous influence, not just in the state capital, but throughout Mississippi. Now, this is the same newspaper that condemns racism all the time and goes real hard on the Klan anytime anything happens. I forget the name of the reporter down there. He's made it his career just to harass the Klan or anybody who may be racist. They and other Baptists had decreed that no Jews could attend the powerful First Baptist Church, and they also kept blacks from joining the existing Jackson Ministerial Associate Organization. Nussbaum took a leading role founding the Greater Jackson Clergy Alliance, a biracial organization that eventually included 60 ministers from 10 denominations, a direct rebuke to the religious power structure of the city. The Baptists and the Hedermans. Nussbaum also served as Secretary of the Clergy Alliance, which held meetings in the black as well as white houses of worship. Nussbaum's activities infuriated Sam Bowers, who continued to mastermind Klan self-defense, really, they say violence, community defense, despite his upcoming federal trial in connection with the slaying of the three civil rights workers at Philadelphia and state and federal trials in Vernon Dahmer's death. Bowers was determined to show authorities that the White Knights remained a potent force. A new campaign of terror was planned, aimed at selected white and black leaders. That sounds more like it. Jews would be the prime targets. Aware of constant FBI surveillance, Bowers and his lieutenants usually met in remote wooded areas and changed meeting places frequently. Let me see if I'm recording this all right. Yeah, it says I'm recording it. On the rare occasions that they met in buildings, they were so fearful of FBI listening devices that they scribbled messages to each other on notebook paper instead of talking. Once after a meeting in his Laurel office to discuss targeting the Jackson Jewish community, Bowers was so concerned about security that he burned the messages, ground the ashes, placed them in a bucket of water, then flushed the contents down the commode. And that's one reason why Sam Bowers was never convicted until later years when they dummied up crap on him. All through those civil wrongs years, he skated because he was smart. Much of this was known to the FBI, which had infiltrated the White Knights with a substantial number of paid informants. There you go. I don't think any of them ever had got a bullet in the head either, as I recall. I don't remember. Maybe it'll be some of that in the book here. But there were no informants within the tiny cell of Klansmen that Bowers talked to about specific plans for attacking the Jews. I forget what they called that group. There's a special name for it. Headed Up by the Preacher was the code name. And almost no one except Bowers, Danny Joe Hawkins, and Kathy Ainsworth knew that Thomas Albert Terrence III had joined the cell. In early September, it was Temple Beth Israel's time to host the annual meeting of the Mississippi Religious Conference, another interracial race-mixing and interreligious organization Nussbaum had helped found. You see, once you give people the bullshit that all men are created equal and all that, then it's downhill. Immediately it's downhill. I mean, how can anybody be a Christian when the ideology is we're all equal? Well, you don't have a leg to stand on. I mean, how can you even argue with your kids about dating people of another race when you buy into the bullshit that the preachers put out? Now, it's interesting that prior to the civil rights movement, it was a different story in most churches, except up north. They went across the line earlier. So shortly before leaving with his wife for a long-scheduled business trip to Italy, wonder what that was all about. He decided to bypass the board and assume personal responsibility for approving the meeting. It bothered Crystal and other members of the congregation that might think he had approved the session knowing he would not be present to catch the heat. Well, it probably was. He should not have worried. One thing other members of the congregation knew, that the Crystals were firm in their support of racial injustice and never hesitated to confront the issue directly. Oh, he's a tough guy. A number of blacks traveled to Jackson for the conference, and several stopped at service stations and food markets in the vicinity to get directions to the temple. Word spread quickly, and an integrated meeting was being held at the synagogue. Reports that blacks attended the meeting appeared in the Jackson Clarion Ledger and Daily News. The meeting and the publicity did indeed touch off a firestorm of protests within the Beth Israel congregation. At a subsequent meeting, several older members accused Nussbaum of endangering the Jewish community and demanded that he resign. Shut up! You're putting too much heat on us, kikes. Nussbaum, whose long-term contract had 5 years to run, made it clear he had no intention of quitting. In fact, he was so incensed by the suggestion that he paced up and down in front of the congregation, denouncing his accusers and declaring they opposed his policies simply because they wanted to keep the blacks out of the synagogue. Yeah, they did. They didn't want to mix with the blacks either. That's why they got problems in Israel with these 120,000 niggers they moved in there. They're gonna rue the day they did that. Plus the fact they've got the, supposedly, I think the world's biggest concentration camp on the southern border there of Israel. I'd like to have been gone out to see it, but that would have blown my Christian cover. Yeah. Where they've got thousands of blacks that have tried to come north and get into Israel, and they just grab them and throw them in this concentration camp. They don't talk about that much in the press, do they? The attack on Nussbaum was led by John Hart Lewis, a wealthy home builder whose grandfather had settled in Jackson in 1848, which proves some people with money fight it. Some people, not that many. A man of strong opinions, Lewis had taken a dislike to Nussbaum when the rabbi, shortly after arriving in Jackson, refused to confirm Lewis' two sons because their mother was not Jewish. Oh, a decision that accorded with Jewish law, but not with the customs of many Mississippi congregations. Now Lewis warned Nussbaum that his policy of integrated meetings, if they continued, the rabbi probably would find himself a target of a bomb. Whoa! In the end, however, a substantial majority of the congregation, led by Manny Crystal, Sid Geiger, and Al Binder, lined up in support of the rabbi. Emboldened, Nussbaum declared, "I've been in Jackson, Mississippi area for 14 years, and I haven't been bombed yet," unquote. Rabbi Lewis replied, "I hope you make it through 15 years. Smoke still drifted up from the wreckage of the synagogue, mixing with the strong smell of insecticide. The city had been spraying for mosquitoes earlier that night. Scores of police officers and FBI agents swarmed over the damaged buildings and grounds around it in search of clues. Terrence had jimmied open several doors and had planted a box of dynamite near a small bathroom adjacent to Nussbaum's study. The explosion wrecked the study and would clearly have killed the rabbi had he been there. The best laid plans of mice and men can go wrong. Jim Ingram and the FBI agent in charge of the civil rights enforcement in Mississippi arrived at the scene. He was shocked that the Klan had decided to target the Jewish community because, in his view, it had done nothing to incite the wrath of the Klan. Bullshit. This rabbi was the main problem. He was the lightning rod. The blast had also awakened Ken Dean at his house four blocks away. He called Ingram to confirm his apprehension about what had happened, then had hurried to the scene. Dean had also telephoned A.I.B. Botnick, regional director of the Anti-Defamation League, at his house in New Orleans. Botnick had promised to set out for Jackson immediately by car. A Clarion Ledger reporter asked Nussbaum if his work with the Committee of Concern and news reports of integrated meetings at the synagogue might have been a factor in the bombing. Nussbaum thought for a moment before answering. Finally, he chose a response that was politic, if not entirely true. "Ridiculous," the rabbi declared. "My work with Committee of Concern had nothing to do with it. My congregation believes in prophetic utterance. Quote, my house shall be a house of prayer for all people, except the Southern Baptists. And we have never turned away anyone from our doors." Well, that's probably why you're losing your parishioners. You let everybody in. The sad fact is that there was a lot of bigotry during the recent state Democratic primary, and distribution of anti-Jew literature didn't help the situation. Then the rabbi's eyes focused on a huge pile of books that lay jumbled on the floor of his ruined study. Over the years, he had carefully accumulated more than 3,000 volumes of Jewish history and literature, including what he considered the best reference collection on the Old Testament in Jackson, Mississippi. Hundreds of irreplaceable volumes were soaked with water pouring from the ruptured pipe. "It's heartbreaking," Nussbaum said, picking up one of the water-soaked volumes. "What they did was an expression of bestiality, which we Jews never do." A policeman searched for evidence remarked that he could not understand anyone bombing a house of worship. You see, that's how this religious fanaticism gets into the bloods. It's ridiculous. This was nothing but a mind control center for the Jews. And all these churches and synagogues are nothing but mind control centers. A house of worship. Worshiping what? They say, God's in the house. Where's the God at? Bring him out. I want to talk to that guy. The rabbi found the comment mind-boggling. Black churches had been destroyed by the dozens all around Jackson, and in previous decade explosions had rocked synagogues and other Jewish institutions in Nashville, Miami, Jacksonville, Birmingham, Atlanta, and Gadsden, Alabama. Well, they couldn't have all been the White Knights. This is not the first synagogue that's been bombed, Nussbaum told the policeman. While the police and FBI agents roped off the synagogue and scoured the area for evidence, the Nussbaums drove back to their house. There, the rabbi sat down and in the early morning hours wrote in his diary. Well, you got to remember one thing. The synagogues are not the center of power of the Jews. The center of power is the big banks. That's the true synagogue. I mean, that's been the true synagogue for a long time in the Federal Reserve System. Yeah, he'll say, oh, well, there are not too many Jews involved, but usually you got a Jew head of the thing. So if you want to go after a synagogue, you shouldn't waste your time on one where there's nothing really going on in a bunch of gaggling Jews yapping at each other. You want to check out the big Jewish banks. No, I didn't say that. Forget that. Erase that. Wait a minute. A few hours ago, our synagogue was bombed. I have given up trying to get sleep or to read. It is nightmarish, this reaction to what for years I have accepted as inevitable. Here's a guy who was looking to be a sacrificial lamb, I guess, and go down in the history books. How can a rabbi sleep when the forces of evil attack their cherished house? I sit here now and wait for the daylight. I told you so's. I warned you that the temple would be bombed. And I wonder, not afraid, wonder, how will the majority of my membership react now? Well, they should fire your kosher ass. Long ago, I've been helplessly reconciled to those who reject my concept of Judaism and the role of the synagogue in Jackson. I have been unable to stop their pursuit of the multitudes for the evil which has afflicted this lovely city and state. These white people are mean and vicious. Last night a policeman said to me, I can't understand how anyone would want to destroy a church. Well, if the church is destroying your culture and your race, it should be the first. That's why they had to come up with a new federal law, like 4 years straight time for blowing up or burning down a church. But all the niggers that burn down their churches for the insurance money, I don't think you'll ever see them do 40 years. My own trauma was too much upon me to remind this well-intentioned sympathizer that over 40 Christian churches have already been destroyed in Mississippi. Well, they were going against the culture, going against the race, so they are a military subject. They're a military operation. That's the way I look at it. I sit in the middle of the night and pray for the light which will maintain Beth Israel in its fifth house, a symbol of brotherhood and love for all people, whoever they are, whatever they are. Well, these guys are something else. They're so full of bullshit that it's amazing. It's amazing. Okay, let's get back at it here. I think I got time for maybe one chapter. In the wake of the bombing, the FBI turned to its formidable network of sources and informants. What's new? If they didn't have an army of informants, the Federal Bureau of Incompetence could never get anything solved. I see they recently got another guy, stupid guy, to talk to him into allegedly going to put a bomb on a beach someplace. Well, a bomb going off on a beach, unless there were people real close to it, wouldn't hurt anybody, because bombs depend on being surrounded and things on top of it, like under a house or under a building or something. Putting a bomb on a beach probably wouldn't hurt that many people. But anyhow, the FBI obviously talked him into it, encouraged him, and now they got him. Oh, we got ourselves a terrorist, man. We're going to put him on trial, put him away for 100 years, man. While the Nussbaum's, Binder, and others in the Beth Israel congregation were still picking through the wreckage, FBI agents descended on the homes of Klansmen on the Bureau's standing roster of suspects in racial bombings. Agents Sam Jennings and Ronald Johnson, race traders, hurried to the residence of Joe Denver Hawkins, the father of Danny Joe Hawkins. When they ran the doorbell, that was the house of the mother of Danny Hawkins that I met the head of the Klan when I visited Mississippi. And then I went to the grave of our martyred hero. When they rang the doorbell, Johnny May Hawkins, Joe Denver's wife, opened the door almost immediately, although it was about 1:30 a.m., a close friend of Kathy Ainsworth. She was one of the toughest, roughest-talking Klan women in Mississippi, a woman who Agent Tom Webb said was always talking about getting the niggers and the outsiders. Yeah, she'd go hunting bear with a stick. We need women like that. She greeted the agents belligerently. What do you want? Don't you know it's after midnight? God damn it, I'm trying to sleep. The agents asked where they could find Joe Denver or Hawkins. She said her husband was asleep and could not be awakened until 6 a.m. Jennings and Johnson were skeptical, lacking authority to search the house they left, but they decided to cruise the area on the chance that Hawkins might be nearby. Before long, their diligence was rewarded. On a side street, not far from his house, they spotted Hawkins, his son Danny Joe, and J.L. Harper, all parked along the curb in separate cars. As the agents approached, Harper sped away, careening down the street with his lights out. The agents followed. Suddenly, behind them, both Joe Denver and Danny Joe pulled out and began to pursue the Bureau car. Jennings and Hawkins radioed their location and called for backup and help us. We got Klansmen chasing us down through the streets of the town. They're going to kill us and bury us in a dam down there on the river. Harper swerved into a... You know, these guys, these Klansmen are really brave guys, man. I mean, they're not only running from the FBI, they're turning around and chasing the FBI. Harper swerved into a parking lot. He did, so did the other three cars, but Joe Denver and Danny Joe suddenly pulled around the bureau car and forced it to an abrupt stop. The agents jumped out. FBI, Johnson shouted. Where were the FBI? He found himself staring at a stub-nosed pistol held by Danny Joe. Joe Denver and Harper joined the confrontation. At that moment, several Jackson police cars converged on the scene. Danny Joe dropped his gun. He and the other two Klansmen, now heavily outnumbered, gave up and were arrested. All three refused to say where they had been that night, and there was no immediate evidence linking them to the synagogue bombing. Still, the FBI considered them prime suspects. The response of the FBI and other police agencies in Mississippi to the Beth Israel bombing was extraordinary. The destruction of black churches and the terrorizing of civil rights activists had been commonplace since the summer of 64. Now remember, this is 67. That's 3 years. With few exceptions, the Vernon Dahmer case, the slaying of Goodman, Swarner, and Cheney in the Neshoba County, there had been little response from the law enforcement agencies. And except for the ministers who made up the Committee of Concern, there had been little or no public outcry against the violence. But the Beth Israel bombing was different. Within hours, Roy Moore and Jackson FBI office ordered an round-the-clock investigation by its famous but incompetent members. And the FBI director, the half-quarter nigger J. Edgar Hoover, dispatched a team of demolition experts to Jackson. Not only a quarter nigger Hoover, but a cross-dressing homosexual, I guess. Yeah, he was a homosexual because I knew a contract agent in California who contacted me years ago. He used to put out a little paper called The Fox Hunter or something like that, The Hound Hunter or something. But anyhow, he told me about how J. Edgar Hoover and his lover, as second in command, I should remember his name, but I don't, how they used to meet down there at the big country club there, only a few miles from me in Fallbrook. They had a little cottage, and that's where they did their screwing and sucking. And, in fact, it was so weird that he said that the second in command would go out to the grocery store and get a bunch of grapes, hang them on a tree limb right outside the window, raise the window, and while they're doing their sucking and fucking, they're reaching out and getting grapes off this bush and eating them. I tell you, I believe the guy. And he'd been a contract agent for the FBI for some time. But he wasn't at the time he talked to me. Other agencies also moved swiftly. Mississippi and Jackson police joined in a massive investigation, helping the FBI check the whereabouts of all known members of the Wild Knots. Publicly, the FBI tried to convey the impression that local and state authorities had primary responsibility for the investigation. The opposite was true. Fully aware of how politically sensitive the matter was, Moore assigned his own men to check every possible lead. An internal FBI report to Moore a week after the bombing said all homes within 1/2 mile radius of the synagogue had been contacted by bureau agents. Numerous residents along logical escape routes from the synagogue have also been contacted by bureau agents. They're running all over the town, turning more and more people against them. This radius included the following streets: Hialeah, Farnsworth, Kaywood, Brerfield, Balmoral, Red Fox, Runnymede, Charter Oak, Westbrook, Meadow Oaks Park, Woodcrest, Reddick, Canton Heights, Banyan, Rollingswood, Kaywood Circle, and applicable blocks of the old Canton Road, unquote. You know, when I was down there, I wish they had taken me over there and see whether, I don't know whether that synagogue got rebuilt or not. Maybe it did. Nobody took me by. In addition, Moore was told that agents had contacted numerous residents along the logical escape routes from the synagogue, including Old Canton Road, Colonial Circle, South Park Drive, and Adkins Boulevard. The report concluded that the investigation had met with negative results by incompetent agents. The dynamiting of the synagogue rattled every one of the 140 Jewish households in Jackson. It shook their long-cherished faith in that their relationships with the Christian community. Why don't they say white community? White community, buddy. These whites might have been Christian, a lot of them, but let's talk about the white community. Built at an enormous price to themselves would keep them safe. Many, Crystal, the young president of the congregation, called a meeting of Jewish leaders to discuss a response to the bombing and ways to protect themselves from further violence. The Anti-Defamation League's B. Botnick was invited, and Ken Dean sat in. Some 40 men from the congregation gathered in a second-floor conference room of the Sun and Sand Motel on September the 19th, the day after the bombing. The motel near the state capitol in downtown Jackson was owned by M.A. Matthews, Jr., a lawyer and former FBI agent, and the brother of John Hart Lewis. The meeting was tumultuous. Many of the younger men, among them Joe Harris, wanted immediate action. After years of distancing themselves from confrontation, they suddenly came to see things differently. Joe Harris put it succinctly, "The blacks had problems with these people, but that was solely their problem until the temple was bombed, and it became our problem, too." His wife, Maxine, described her attitude with equal candor. "We never wanted to get involved. We just wanted to go along like almost everyone else and whatever is happening. Let it happen. We didn't want our four children being pounced on. They were all in school. We just wanted to be Americans, to be citizens, with dual citizenship. We just wanted to be left alone until it affected us. And then it affected us, and it was our children. But you were super pro-Israel people. And Israel is a... all over the world, they're creating havoc and building arms that other people use to create havoc. But you still claim your hands are so clean. There's no blood on our hands. We're such wonderful people. Why do people keep picking on us?" Several men, including Harrison Binder, another latecomer to the cause, were ready for immediate action. Some suggested forming a vigilante group to protect the Jewish community. Enter Ir Rubin. No, Ir Rubin was still in Canada. Ir Rubin was too young to be involved in this. Mark Ahani might have been old enough. What the hell happened to those guys? I don't think they showed up. Oh, incidentally, I heard the other day that the guy who assassinated Mark Ahani, the head of the JDL, was later involved in the planting of, I don't know, hundreds of pounds of dynamite in the World Trade Center the first time they tried to take the World Trade Center down. And you know what? He never served a day for killing Mark Ahani. Now, that was interesting. I think Mark Ahani talked straight, and you know, he was totally a Jew nationalist or whatever. And I read his book, They Must Go, and so forth. And so the big shot Zionists wanted him out of the way. And I think they were behind killing him, or allowing him to be killed, just like Malcolm X. They had never dreamed the Klan would attack the Jewish community, and now they seemed almost paralyzed. any conspicuous action could backfire. Their warning and calling attention to themselves could only hurt Jews. The hell with everybody else. After all, the Klan's wrath already had been incurred by the outspoken rabbi and his and the crystals and a few others. When the meeting broke up after 2 hours, there was no agreement on a strategy. Another clusterfuck. The next day, Binder went to the Jackson office of the FBI and asked Roy Moore for advice on how to proceed. Moore said, hide under a table. No. Moore told him that bombings were among the most difficult of all crimes to solve because they're usually left little or no evidence. He must have been a Klan sympathizer. It was a subject Moore knew more than a little about. He had made his reputation in the FBI with the groundbreaking investigation of a famous case in which an airliner with 44 persons aboard had been blown up over Colorado. Moore's success in the case that caused J. Edgar Hoover to turn to him in 64 when the Bureau came under pressure to solve the disappearance of the three civil wrongs workers in a Philadelphia dam. Scientific investigation had helped Moore crack the airliner case. I wonder what that was about. But the best way to catch terrorists, he said, told, they're always terrorists, he said. Nobody's ever a guerrilla fighter. Well, if they're your friends, they're guerrilla fighters. If they're enemies, they're always a terrorist. He told Binder would be to pay informants. That's the FBI is always their answer. Never changes. To solve any crime, he said, you need one of three factors, a confession, a witness, or physical evidence. And a Klan bombing, he added, usually left you with none of the three, unless you put up money for informants, snitches, and rats. There's always some of them around, right? Right. Especially in the FBI itself, who sold more secrets of this country than any other group. People forget about that. The FBI had been paying Klan informants for some time. Of course, it's the only way they can solve crimes. Such payments are a staple of police work everywhere. Yeah! Even local cops do it, but not like the feds. And they had been pivotal to the Bureau's success against the Klan in the Philadelphia slayings and the attack on Vernon Dahmer. Thus far, and of course, do you think they really cared about Vernon Dahmer? No, it was a challenge to the feds. You know, that's the problem. You know, any challenge to the federal system, the ruling class, has got to be taken care of. Not because we give a shit about the people that got killed, but it's just it. We cannot have this. Thus far, the Bureau had operated with its own funds. In this case, Moore took a different tact. He told Binder that the Bureau did not have the money needed for an operation of this sensitivity. Moore was acting partly out of the concern for limited Bureau budget. Oh, they were giving too much money to Israel already. They didn't have any money for informants. Buying information was expensive, and it was hard to know how much money it might be needed. And the members of the Beth Israel congregation, unlike poor blacks in Hattiesburg and Neshoba County, or the emotionally devastated families and friends of Schwerner and Goodman, might reasonably be expected to pay their own way. But according to Jim Ingram, Moore probably sensed that he was stepping into uncharted territory and concluded it might be useful to operate off the books. Like the FBI usually does. As we wanted, we want anything in writing. We didn't want anything in writing, of course not. Just like all of those war criminals in Washington. Nothing could immediately of the Binder's discussions with Moore, but a seed was planted. A few days later, another meeting was called in what amounted to the center of Jackson's power structure, the conference room of the First National Bank. There you go. There's the synagogue. That is a serious synagogue, the First National Bank. Almost every important business, professional, or religious leader in the city attended. Binder and several of the other young Jews made it clear that what they wanted from the white community was not money or sympathy, but clear expressions of outrage. Outrage! we want you to say the bombing is wrong. Who is going to say the bombing was right? And we want you to come out in the newspaper and tell people and the congregations of these preachers here that it is wrong. Binder declared, and we want these preachers to get off the pulpit and off their ass and go out into their flock and fucking flock and tell them this is wrong. The Capitol's movers and shakers, clearly unhappy at the being upbraided, tried to take a soothing approach. Yeah, now let's not get too excited here. Now, we understand, we sympathetic, but we just calm down a little there, Jew boy. No one challenged the binder openly. As the meeting ended, however, Ed Brunini, a senior partner in one of Jackson's largest law firms, there you go, and brother of Jackson's Catholic bishop, another pseudo-Jewish outfit, Joseph Brunini, put his arm around Binder and said, "Son, you're just too sensitive. You know we all love you. Why, you're the mayor's best friend. But you're just judging us too harshly." Binder said nothing at first, but did a slow burn at Brunini's patronizing remark when it sank in. Turning to Monsignor Bernard Law, Binder remarked, "Don't you know that when they get through with us, you're next? They hate Catholics worse than they hate Jews. They always have in Mississippi." With that, he turned and left the building. Binder was exaggerating. The Klan was hostile to Catholics, but its animus towards Jews had always been much more overt and intense. Nonetheless, Binder felt his comments might at least prod the Catholics into speaking out. Gratifying expressions of support did not come in from other quarters, including the Diocesan Council of Catholic Women, which deplored the cowardly acts of violence. Mayor Alan Thompson, who had remained silent about the black churches, now expressed shock that anyone would bomb a house of worship, Jew worship. "Some of our best people are members of the Jewish faith," Thompson declared in a prepared press statement. "Many of these are descendants of people who helped build this city that we all love and are ready to defend from any and every form of bigotry and violence." Just as outspoken was Governor Paul Johnson, who also had not spoken out about the anti-black terrorism. "It is almost unthinkable that this kind of cowardly assault on a house of Sheenies could be carried out in this civilized state among our civilized white people," he said. The Clarion Ledger ran a letter from Mrs. Robert Levy under the headline, "Temple Blast Could Be a Bell That Tolls for All of Jackson. Those Klan people going to kill every motherfucker in this town if you don't do something. I'll bet my husband's foreskin." Mrs. Levy, who had taught 20 children in the temple the night before the bombing and whose own two children had been in other classrooms that evening, wrote that the bombing had shocked her white friends, and that while it was not the first time that they had heard of a synagogue being desecrated, possibility it is the first time they really know a Jewish family who worships there. "They will take this violence more personally," Mrs. Levitz wrote, "but the message will not get through. My Christian white friends will not see that when my temple was destroyed, their churches suffered the same fate. And when their children's lives are in danger, so are the lives of their children." Well, no, those were black churches that they blowed up and burnt down. They weren't doing much bombing and burning of white churches. They certainly weren't going after the Southern Baptist churches, because they'd come out and kick your ass. In a more significant departure, the Clarion Ledger printed in A.B. Albrighton's Magnolia Mirror column an attack on the coward who had terrorized blacks and finally resorted to violence against Jews. addressing the Knight Riders, Al Britton unabashedly underscored the difference in Mississippi's establishment response to terrorism when it was directed towards whites rather than blacks. Every now and then you kill a negro just to show you mean business, but this time you've destroyed a beautiful place of worship where people who share a common belief come together to do that. You've bombed churches before, but never one where white people worshiped. This is Mississippi, and we've had enough. We'll get you and all the rest of your gutless friends. Now, don't bother me. I got to get down in my bomb shelter here and lock the door before the sun goes down. Scores of Mississippi Christian ministers, silent while blacks were being terrorized, now came forward to express their outrage and, in some cases, their guilt. In an editorial, the Methodist advocate said, "We are guilty of having Christians always want to feel guilty about something. They always want to say, 'I'm guilty, that's terrible, I swear, oh, baby Jesus, forgive me.' We are guilty of having allowed a climate to be created about us which lends us to the propagation of prejudice, a climate based upon opposition to and open flouting of federal law, and have thus created disrespect for law at all levels. These white people defending their culture and their homes here in the South and states' rights, they're horrible people. We got to get rid of them. We have been silent in the face of obvious injustice, and murderers walk the streets of our state because no jury had the courage to convict them. No, they had the balls to set them loose. We have been afraid to get involved in anything that might be the least bit disturbing to the established power structure." There's that power structure again. "Just as long as good men of all faiths remain silent and inert, so long will this violence continue. Just as long as one house of worship is unsafe, so long will all the houses of worship be the target. They're coming after you people, too. Even you, Southern Baptists. They come after us, Southern Baptists. We'll kiss your ass." 4 days after the bombing, Reverend Thomas Tiller, an Episcopalian who served as president of the Jackson Clergy Alliance, which Nussbaum had helped found 2 months earlier, led a walk of penance to the temple by about 40 ministers, including 3 black ministers. Armed police officers guarded the marchers, but there was no counter-demonstrators or incidents. Well, that's the way guerrillas do act. They're not going to come out in the open in the daylight. They're going to use good guerrilla tactics. Some might say lone wolf. The Jackson community had closed ranks around the Jewish congregation, bunch of phony hypocrites, and the more vocal segregationists apparently decided to keep their distance. Yeah, they didn't need to. They acted. They didn't stand around on the street corner. A new day of understanding and courage had not arrived for the Jackson clergy, however. Several conscience-stricken ministers who sympathized with Nussbaum and his congregation did some heavy soul-searching, if they could find it, but concluded nevertheless that they could not afford to join the walk of penance. The First Christian Church minister, Reverend William Harold Eads, and associate minister, William E. McKnight, wrote Nussbaum a personal letter saying they regretted they could not participate. These preachers, they're all phony as hell. They're all phony, claiming they got power, they talk directly to God, and the baby Jesus visits them in the night, and so forth. I mean, they have no more respect from me than as a carpenter or a electrician. I have more respect for laborers, ditch diggers, and that goes for nigger ditch diggers too, than I do a preacher. They always have them come up in front of the city hall and meetings and all that kind of stuff and pray and all that, and you give them all kinds of respect. Bullshit. Had we chosen to be part of the walk, we would probably need to prepare to leave the ministers of First Christian Church our congregation has, grown, we believe, in the right direction, but the members as well as their pastors have a long way to go. Like other clergymen, we too share the agony and frustration in such a time as this. What a bunch of bullshit. The two ministers wrote, especially are our hearts heavy when we're forced to realize the horrible disease that afflicted many in our state, and many ways we confess we share it. We are guilty too. May God have mercy on us. Well, you got a problem. Mother Nature won't have a mercy on you. Survival of the fittest won't have mercy on you. And leaders of the largest, most powerful denomination in the state, the Baptists, were conspicuous by their absence. They're the really bad ones, man. Nussbaum was worried about his own safety and that of his wife. Even the discovery that a flower pot in his yard had been knocked over unnerved the rabbi. Hey, wife, there's a pot out there. It's been tipped over. It may be a bomb. You go out and check it out, will you, honey? The FBI reported a memo that he noticed that a small flower pot, usually in his garden, had been turned over in the center of his sidewalk. He said he has no pets around the house and cannot imagine how that flower pot had been turned over. Well, the baby Jesus did it. He said he was fearful of picking up the flower pot and placing it in the garden. Rabbi Nussbaum was advised to call the local police and advise them on the possible prowler end of the flower pot situation, that he said he would immediately do so. There got to be a Klansman in my garden, man. Let me see how much time I got going here. I haven't been watching the clock. Hell, I don't know. Probably got enough for two shows. Oh, I think that's about it for today. I'm so excited, I want to have a drink or something. Nussbaum was worried about his own safety and that of his wife. Even the discovery of the flower pot in his yard had knocked over, unnerved the rabbi. Wow. He's a scared rabbi. He is a scared rabbi. And he should be. If they'd have had more people like the White Knights, they could have turned the thing around using military tactics and going after the right targets. Unfortunately, there were not that many really super bright guys around to carry out that stuff. Hawkins was smart. Bowers was smart. But most of the people they were dealing with that couldn't be trusted. A mile away from the Clavering, man. Sorry. Okay, that's it. 14:05. We'll be back tomorrow on Thursday and see if we can... You know, this is getting interesting because a lot of it I didn't know about and a lot of it I've forgotten. Yeah. Oh, shit. The famous bit incompetence outside. Give me my gun, man. Give me my gun.